TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Peter Dale Scott, The American Deep State, Wall Street, Big Oil, and the Attack on U.S. Democracy. There was a heavy rainstorm and flooding in the forecast for November 9, but a group of friends and colleagues were undaunted and came to the opening party for Peter Dale Scott's 2014 book on the Deep State, published by Roman and Littlefield. We met in the poetry room of the historic City Lights bookstore and publishing house in San Francisco's North Beach. Professor Peter Dale Scott is a Canadian-born former diplomat and retired professor of literature at UC Berkeley. He's the author of many books and articles on state terrorism, surveillance, drug dealing by the CIA, and political assassinations. In part one of this program, Professor Scott spoke about the hidden deep state that influences and often opposes official U.S. policies. He explained that the deep state is a second order of government behind the public or constitutional state. It is acting through non-accountable intelligence agencies like the CIA and NSA, as well as private corporations like Booz Allen Hamilton and the Science Applications International Corporation. Now you are about to hear the lively Q&A session that followed his talk. The first question came from Jonathan Marshall. He and Professor Scott co-wrote The Iran-Contra Connection and Cocaine Politics, Drugs, Armies, and the CIA in Central America. Jonathan Marshall asked, "Do you think Obama has fostered the interests of this deep state? Or has he also in some ways tried to push back, only to be foiled?" Peter Dale Scott.
Well, it's a bit early to answer that kind of question, but obviously I think about it a great deal. I think at the beginning he hoped to make some significant changes. I think his 2009 speech about the Arab world, was it in Cairo? That was, I think, an attempt to break with the existing rules. But I said in my last book that there's a mindset in Washington, and the president doesn't choose the mindset. The mindset chooses the president. And there was also talk at the beginning that Obama wanted to be another FDR. But FDR, he was a patrician to begin with, and he had a party machine behind him. He had worked up through state politics. He came with an army of people to support him. Obama is a very different figure. He was chosen from above. And most of our presidents now are chosen from above. I think George W. Bush was chosen from above. So they're there, and they're not really in a position to deal with these massive bureaucracies, some of which, like CIA and NSA, are frankly out of control, not within the capacity. So what is striking is that some of the worst features of the Bush administration, from my point of view, have got still worse under Obama. The drones, the use of the Espionage Act. Espionage Act, you would think, means spying for another country. If somebody spies for the American people, like Edward Snowden, he faces charges under the Espionage Act. And you've probably heard this before, but I'm going to say it again, that more people have been indicted under the Espionage Act for this kind of crime, if it's a crime, under Obama than all previous presidents put together. So I can't speak to Obama's intentions. I can speak to his results. If he had wanted to do something in his lame duck era, you know, he's in a sense free more than he was before, he should end the state of emergency, get that army back. Well, we should really cut back on the armies altogether, but that's another issue. What is it Zhou Enlai said about the French Revolution? Is it a good or a bad thing? It's too early to tell. It's too early to tell, surely, I think, about the Obama administration.
That was Peter Dale Scott's answer for his friend and co-author, Jonathan Marshall. The next question came from me. Say a little more about the army brigade that's ready to deal with us in the streets if the police can't.
In an early draft of my book, maybe it's still there, I said this is where America crossed the Rubicon, you know, that we have an army running this country. Actually, as I thought about it a bit more, back right after Martin Luther King assassination, you had all the riots in the inner cities in Detroit and Washington. We had two brigades in this country, and they were mobilized in 68, and then they were demobilized very quickly in 1971 for a very good reason, and that is that, more or less accidentally, Congress discovered that Army intelligence had files on 100,000 Americans, and they didn't feel that this was the right job of the U.S. Army. And, of course, the CIA was also, in its Operation Chaos, was also not just surveilling Americans, but actually mounting covert operations in this country, which was definitely against their charter. It was an extreme time. In fact, in my book, I have a chapter about the two decades of, from 1960 to 1980. Let's go through them. One president was assassinated. His successor could not stand for re-election because he had such problems with the army. The next president, Nixon, had to resign. The next two presidents, both Ford and Carter, they were incumbent presidents who lost the chance for re-election, something that hadn't happened in this country since Herbert Hoover. So there was something unusual with every single president. And in every case, I argue, it was because they got into trouble with the deep state. And then when you go on the other side, you look at the CIA directors. I believe we had seven in those two decades. And certainly some of them, like Dulles and Helms, conspicuously were fired because the president felt that they were not behaving in accordance with the wishes of the president. President Kennedy said famously that he wanted to break the CIA into 1,000 pieces. It wasn't President Kennedy who succeeded in that matter, and I don't want to say that the CIA killed him, but somebody killed him, and I doubt that the CIA had nothing to do with it. I don't want to pin all the blame on them, but they had something to do with it.
The next question for Peter Dale Scott covered a lot of turf. Please comment on the counter-revolution that happened at the Continental Congress and on the drug wars.
Oh boy, that's a tall order. The one I know most about is the drug war. I'll talk about it as how it relates to this book. That one of my theses is that the CIA has never, ever had to depend on Congress for all of its funding. That Alan Dulles was asked in 1946, he's a Wall Street lawyer at the time, he's asked by the head of the Central Intelligence Group, General Vandenberg, to draft a program for a CIA, and his draft is ultimately the one that is adopted in 1947. At the same time, what we call the Marshall Plan was also being planned and actively advocated by Alan Dulles. And it was also passed into law, but Dulles had arranged that a percentage, a significant percentage of Marshall Plan funds would be devoted to covert activities in Europe. And so that meant Congress was voting money for aid to Europe. That's all they knew. They didn't know that a good deal of that money was being spent to make contact among other people, drug traffickers, like in the port of Marseille, which was crucial for French aid going to the French war in Vietnam, which they quickly lost interest in, but the Americans continued to finance, and they forced the French, in effect, to continue it. And they broke the power of the communist trade unions in Marseille with the use of another trade union, which some of whose leaders were involved in the drug traffic. I give the example, Jonathan Marshall, who's here, he and I wrote a book together called Cocaine Politics. And in the second edition of that book, we were able to report that the was leaked first, I think, by CBS and the Wall Street Journal, that the CIA had collaborated in the illegal import of over a ton of cocaine into this country from a man in Venezuela. And there was a huge uproar about that, and one CIA man had to resign. He was not prosecuted. And the Venezuelan was indicted, but he stayed in Venezuela, and nothing happened to him. And a few years later, in the first attempted coup against Chavez in Venezuela, one of the people who figured in that coup was the same Venezuelan.
That was Peter Dale Scott's answer in a Q&A session at the release party for his new book, The American Deep State: Wall Street, Big Oil, and the Attack on U.S. Democracy. The next question was, today being Madison's birthday, I'm asking for your comment on voter suppression and American democracy.
Oh, my gosh. Well, American democracy is in very, very bad state. And if I was going to start, what is the worst feature, I would say, is the Supreme Court decision, which essentially now allows unlimited and unsourced funds to go into elections anywhere. I would say this is a visible outward sign that we're living in a plutocracy, but I think we were living in a plutocracy even before that Supreme Court decision. Gore Vidal said, the trouble with this country, it's governed by one party with two right wings. And I'll give you an example. There was a candidate in Chicago, a Democrat. She was an incumbent, and she was fighting her campaign to be reelected on calling for an investigation of 9/11. And what did the Democratic National Committee under Rahm Emanuel do? They ran an outsider against her in the primary and put so much money into that primary that the incumbent was defeated by her own party. And then we had Dennis Kucinich, who I'd say was probably the best example of an honest congressman who was in a very guarded way raising some of these issues. Now, maybe we should blame the Republicans for that, but he could have been saved by the Democratic Party, and he's gone.
Another question for Professor Scott was, what could produce change?
All I can say here is don't lose hope. Don't lose hope. It's very easy to paint a very bleak picture of America, and somebody who does that much better than me is Noam Chomsky. But it's also possible, and we have any number of people who do this, who paint very rosy pictures of America, and those pictures are not devoid of evidence. America is a great tabula rasa. It's as many people have said, Rorty and others, America's a project. The Constitution was not a final solution, it was a first step. The Civil War, a horribly painful event, was another step. The Civil Rights Movement, I mean, if there's been a really major, what you might almost say, revolution in American social structure, it was the Civil Rights Movement. That was in my lifetime and the lifetime of most people in this room. And that was, again, painful, and the people died, but it was a success for change. And that's why I write my poem to Mario Savio, because he was in the South. He was beaten up by a citizen for walking in the streets of a southern city with a black man, and that could get you beaten up in those days. That's changed. It is unutterably changed. So it is possible for good things to happen in this country. And oh man, if I could have spelled out exactly what to do, it wouldn't have just been the last chapter of my book, it would have been the whole book. But I'm not even an American, so I think I'll let other people do that. I feel, since finishing my book, I was ordering some other books that I wanted to read as soon as I finished the index. And as I read them now, I see a lot of things which should have been in my book and aren't. I'm 85. I think somebody else is going to have to pursue this. I would say this is a very fruitful line of research, and particularly what I feel I should have done more work on are private intelligence networks. There's a man called Brian Crozier in London who had one, the 61, and they are in all the right places to explain events. I do talk about, like, the in particular, the so-called October surprise, which defeated Jimmy Carter. I want to say a little bit more about that, because if you say to many historians about the October surprise defeated Jimmy Carter, and they say, oh, no, it wasn't that. It was the rise in oil prices. But that's part of what I write. Robert Parry has done a wonderful job writing about the October surprise. He doesn't talk about the increase in oil prices, but he should, because the official explanation is that the Shah was overthrown and the flow of oil from Iran was radically affected. The flow of oil that was really radically affected came from Saudi Arabia, and they didn't cut it off, but they reduced it because they were so angry at the Camp David Accords, which didn't solve the problem of Jerusalem. So they cut back on oil, and I'm convinced they did it in conjunction with big oil, because what was big oil doing in the same period? They actually, in the height of the crisis, they were importing more oil than they had the previous year. And they were refining it and turning it into gasoline and then exporting it out of the country. So that's why you had these long lines, which was terrible for the citizens and, of course, terrible for Jimmy Carter, that he was sort of derided as an ineffectual president who couldn't keep the economy working. And, of course, with the rise in prices, everything went wrong. Interest rates, everything went wrong. So when I say the October surprise, it's really the package which involved both the activity of intelligence agents, former intelligence agents, something called the Safari Club, which you'll have to read my book to find out about, and big oil all working together to make sure that President Reagan could come in. And by the way, the same people, I think, I suggest, there was a group in the Pinay Cercle who worked simultaneously to elect Maggie Thatcher in England in 79, and Reagan. Reagan was an old ally of the CIA from the 1950s when he was the spokesman for Common Cause, which was raising money for CIA projects in Eastern Europe. And the two people they elected did what they really wanted to see. They broke the power of the trade unions, particularly in England, but also by breaking the PATCO strike in America. That's what Reagan did. Never seen the same role for trade unions, which, among other things, has meant we have a very different Democratic Party now, which is not based on union support the way it used to be.
Another guest at the book release party for Peter Dale Scott wanted to know if there's a difference between the interests of the deep state and the empire.
I think certain very influential people decided that from now on they would, in a concerted way, invest overseas. And that's when you see the offshoring of many, many industries and the rise of the Rust Belt, and we now get our steel from abroad and all kinds of, our shoes, everything, that things that used to be made here. And if you're going to do these things offshore, you want to be sure that what you're investing in is secure. So that's why I think that the corporate class in this country wants to see a powerful U.S. Army. We have bases in, what is it, 170 countries, something like that. It is particularly useful for big oil because it's changed now with fracking and the rise of U.S. production. But at the time that Cheney and Rumsfeld came to power and we had 9/11, Cheney in particular kept saying that the big new future frontier for oil development was going to be Central Asia. And already Chevron had a big contract with Kazakhstan and Halliburton that Cheney ran in that period. was doing the hard construction and development in those areas, and they expected to do much more. Now, you don't need to invade Kazakhstan, but the head of Kazakhstan, the president, was obviously going to be under a lot of pressure from Russia, which is his neighbor. So you want him to be under equivalent pressure from U.S. armies in countries like Afghanistan and Iraq. And so I think that all those wars for Iraq, there was a debate, was Iraq about oil? It wasn't just about oil in Iraq. It was very much, I think, about maintaining U.S. dominance over oil production in the world as a whole, including casting a shadow of influence over Central Asia, where they expected at that time, the expectations have changed, but at that time, they expected to see a lot more development in Central Asia. So the empire, to come back to your question, serves the needs of the deep state, but it isn't like the deep state is subservient to the empire. I think the empire is something done largely by public government and public budgets, alas, that the deep state wants.
That was Peter Dale Scott's answer for a guest at the release party for his new book, The American Deep State. The next person wanted to know his ideas about the connections between deep state ideas and the increasing power of corporations in America and the role of the media.
This is a process which is happening all over the world, not just in America. We are seeing more and more concentration, not just of productive corporations, but very importantly of the media. The media did not play in the Iraq role the role that they played back in the Vietnam War, or even in Iran-Contra, where they dug stuff up. The media consented to be completely embedded in the U.S. Army and to go where the Army told them to go. And so the regular, some people say the mainstream media, I call them the governing media, did not do what you would expect the media to do, and which the Founding Fathers, by the way, expected. They felt media were part of the social structure that they were calling for, was an independent free press. And with concentration, we don't have it. Luckily, we do have some new things, like the Internet, the chief obvious one. The Internet is a kind of gift that can be taken away, I think, at any time. But we do have it, and we should certainly use it as long as we can.
And the last questioner for Professor Scott asked if the Bill Clinton impeachment was a deep state event and whether Hillary was right in calling it a vast right-wing conspiracy. Here's the answer.
I totally agree. There was a vast right-wing conspiracy. I'm not sure. You see, the politics of the deep state are hard to summarize, and I maybe should have tried harder to do this. You had a billionaire, Richard Mellon Scaife, who was funding the journal that really went after that. I've never understood why an old friend of mine, Jeff Gerth, at the New York Times, did one of the first of the Whitewater stories. I just can't figure that out. But there was a vast right-wing conspiracy. I don't think it was a conspiracy of the deep state. It was a conspiracy of what I would say perhaps even a marginal element in the deep state. I think that there's probably a lot of confusion right now in Wall Street, that some people like the idea of less government, less oversight, particularly when some people are talking about regulating financial markets. That's pretty revolutionary. So that some people are very, hopeful that the Republicans will get in and put an end to all that kind of nonsense. But there are other problems, like global warming. It may be that global warming is going to be the solution to this problem, because as it is now, Washington is completely paralyzed and can't do anything about anything. And if somebody tries to take a sensible position about global warming, then millions of dollars come in to defeat that person. So, but at the same time, major corporations, including Big Oil, are coming around to see that it can't go on like this and that something has to be done. And if we have enough Hurricane Sandys, and we may be having one tonight, I gather, or pretty
tomorrow.
The East Coast is having one right now. If we have enough of these, so in other words, very difficult to predict the future. But I think going back to Clinton, I would say, yes, there was a conspiracy against him, and it had deep state elements, but I wouldn't say it was the deep state doing it. It was a slightly marginal group, really. Richard Mellon Scaife is important because he's a grandson. He's not somebody who really, you know, like a Bill Gates who's done something on his own. He just happens to have a lot of money and likes to spend it for these kind of causes. Well, I think I'm going to stop. Thank you very much.
You've heard a Q&A period with Professor Peter Dale Scott at the release party for his 2014 Roman and Littlefield book, The American Deep State, Wall Street, Big Oil, and the Attack on U.S. Democracy. I recorded him on November 9, 2014, at City Lights Bookstore and Publishing House in San Francisco's North Beach. Peter Dale Scott is a Canadian-born former diplomat and retired professor of literature at UC Berkeley. He's the author of many books and articles on state terrorism, surveillance, drug dealing by the CIA, and political assassinations. His website is www.peterdalescott.net, and Peter Dale Scott is one word. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. You can get information on how to order a one-hour CD at cost on tucradio.org or by calling 1-707-463-2654. TUC Radio's free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. TUC Radio's mailing address is Post Office Box 44, Calpella, California, 95418. That's Calpella, California, 95418. For more information, call 707-463-2654 or go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org, for the address and donate buttons. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.